Executive Power, Disc 8.
Rapp held up his hands in an effort to calm his wife. Caring too much for Irene to let her take the heat for something she didn't do wasn't his style, and, in addition, something told him that when the two most important women in his life got together and compared notes, they would discover that it was not Irene's fault. "Anna, don't blame this on Irene. Why shouldn't I?" she snapped. "Because, as far as she knew, I was not directly involved in the operation." Anna took a moment to try to decipher the importance of what her husband had just said.
"What do you mean? She's your boss."
"Well, she just, she's busy. She doesn't have time to micromanage something that's happening thousands of miles away." Rapp watched nervously as his wife's face twisted into a skeptical frown. Trying to stop her from scrutinizing his words too closely, he said, "Hey, the important thing is I'm home and I'm safe." Smiling, he added, "I've got a little scrape that you won't even notice in a week or two."
"What are you talking about?" shouted an incredulous Anna. "You were shot in the ass."
She reached out to take a swat at his butt, but he blocked her.
"Honey, let's calm down." "Don't honey me, and don't tell me to calm down. A couple of inches in the other direction, and you could have been hit in an artery, or maybe even your dick, you stupid macho jerk."
"But I wasn't. I'm fine. Don't worry about it. It won't happen again."
"Yeah, right," snarled Anna, without an ounce of sincerity. "So tell me something, Mr. Big Shot, Mr. Tip of the Spear."
Anna used her fingers to make mocking quotation marks in reference to several articles that had been written about his role in America's battle against terrorism. "You're pretty high up on the totem pole. In fact, the last time I checked, you only take orders from two people, the President and Irene. Isn't that right?" Anna poked him in the chest with a finger. Rapp chose not to answer the question.
"So if Irene didn't order you to be involved in the rescue, then who did? I doubt it was the President."
Rapp hesitated, then decided to keep his mouth shut.
"You did, didn't you?"
Slowly he began to nod and then said, "Yeah."
"You asshole. You lied to me."
"No, I didn't," Rapp said, shaking his head.
"Don't even try it, Mitchell." Anna shook her fist at him. "You told me you were done with this type of stuff."
"No, I never said that." Anna took a deep breath, trying to gain some composure, and then let out a banshee-like scream. Rapp put his hands out to grab her shoulders and try to calm her, but she retreated too quickly. She shook her fist at him, saying,
"Oh, I swear to God, I could hit you right now."
Anna's jaw was set and her fists were clenched in rage. She needed to get away from him, to sort things out, to try to make sense of how she had been so naive. She turned and took a step toward the door. Rapp let his hands fall and started to follow her.
"Anna, don't worry. Everything is going to be fine."
The "don't worry" part was what really got to her. It was only her life they were discussing. The man she loved more than anyone in the world had lied to her and then got shot, and she was being told not to worry as if they'd had some slight misunderstanding. It was too much to handle. Her entire body tight with rage, she spun and delivered a clean punch to her unsuspecting husband. Rapp would have been able to block the blow if his eyes had been open, but unfortunately they were closed while he cursed himself out for being so monumentally stupid. The blow stopped him dead in his tracks, causing him to stumble back a step. Instinctively, his hands snapped up in defense as he prepared to grab hold of his wife's wrists, but she was done with him. She stormed from the room with tears welling in her eyes. Rapp was left alone in the bedroom to ponder the mess he had created. Chapter 46. "Trust me, I'm not happy about it either," said an unusually agitated Irene Kennedy into the phone that she was clutching. Mitch Rapp stood in the doorway of his boss's office, following the conversation in complete shock and trying to make sense of what was happening. It appeared that his worst nightmare was taking place before his very eyes. Things were spiraling out of control, and for Mitch, who was very much accustomed to being in charge, it was unnerving. Rapp's body was stiff from sleeping on the couch, and his rear end hurt almost as badly as it had right after he'd been shot. His left eye was slightly swollen, and a headache seemed to be just over the horizon.
Rapp stood on the threshold of the sun-filled office and wondered what forces had allowed this cruel alliance to form against him. The more he listened to his boss, the worse things looked for him. No. Kennedy shook her head while holding the phone. No. Oh, that's great, the director of the CIA said with rare sarcasm. She looked up at Rapp disapprovingly from behind her brown glasses. No, he didn't bother to tell me that he'd been shot in the ass. She scowled at him and pointed sternly at a chair in front of her desk. In all of his years of knowing Kennedy, he had never seen her show this much emotion. Last night with his wife was bad enough, but Kennedy had always been someone he could depend on. This just might be intolerable. Rapp stepped into the office and closed the heavy soundproof door. The administrative assistants didn't need to hear this. He walked slowly across the large office as his boss continued discussing his bad behavior with his wife. The whole thing was very unsettling. No, Kennedy said, you don't need to apologize to me. I can see why you thought it was my fault. She stopped talking and listened for a few seconds. Then, in response to whatever it was that Anna had said, she replied, Well, that is very nice of you to say. I feel the same way. And believe me, you can count on me for the same thing. I think the two of us are more than up to the task. Rapp closed his eyes and let out a low groan. He felt like he was back in grade school, standing in the school office listening to his principal and mother conspire against him on the phone. Yes, I'll be the judge of what is classified and what isn't. She spun her chair around, turning her back to Rapp. Then, shaking her head, she said, Yes, don't listen to him anymore. If you have any questions, pick up the phone and call me. Again, Kennedy paused to listen and then said, Exactly. I couldn't agree more. I might even recommend that he spend some time with one of our in-house psychiatrists. Rapp stared at the back of his boss's head and said, Over my dead body. Kennedy spun her leather chair back around and shot him a glare. All right, Anna, I'll see you in a couple hours, and I've got you down for drinks on Thursday at 6. Thank you. Okay. Oh, and I wouldn't worry about that other thing. He's tough, and as I already said, he more than had it coming. She nodded several times and then said, All right. Bye-bye. Kennedy slowly replaced the handset, keeping her inquisitive eyes locked on Rapp. Well, that was an interesting conversation. I bet. Replied Rapp, with no effort to conceal his displeasure. Kennedy looked at his face. Nice shiner. Where'd you get it? Doubting her sincerity, he said, I slipped in the shower. Really? At least you didn't fall on your behind. Kennedy pointed to one of the chairs in front of her desk and said, Sit. Rapp shook his head. No, thanks. I think I'll stand. Sit! Replied his boss in a voice more stern than anything he'd ever heard from her. Rapp carefully lowered himself into one of the chairs and with a fake smile said, There. Are you happy?
Hardly.
Kennedy snatched her glasses from her face and placed both elbows on her desk. You have got some major explaining to do. The reserved, analytical Kennedy was amazed at how good it felt to let her pent-up anger out. Rapp, put in the unusual position of having to remain the calm one, said, I think everyone needs to relax a bit.
Nice try, but you are way out of bounds on this one. When in the hell were you planning on telling me that you were shot?
Oh, come on, Irene. You've got enough stuff to worry about with running this place. Rapp dismissed her concerns with a wave of his hand, as if one of her top advisors and best operatives getting shot was utterly trivial. You don't need to worry about every little injury to one of your people in the field. An offended, angry expression fell across her face. Her brown eyes focused intently on him, and she said, That hurt. Rapp was completely mystified. His head hurt, his eye hurt, and his ass was absolutely killing him. How could a few words hurt? What are you talking about?
You, she started in an angry tone, are not just simply one of my many employees. Next to my son and my mother, you are probably the dearest friend to me in the entire world, so I would appreciate it if you wouldn't insult my feelings by portraying me as some detached boss who has no concern for her employees.
That's not what I meant, said Rapp as he shook his head.
That is what you said and what you meant, and don't insult me further by trying to retailor your words.
Oh, for Christ's sake, Rapp started to stand. I can't take all of this estrogen.
Kennedy stood abruptly and yelled, Then take a little testosterone. Sit your ass back down, mister.
My ass hurts too much to sit. Thank you very much. Don't try to turn this around on me, Mitchell. This is not my fault. When you called me, requesting that I get full authority for you to plan the hostage rescue, you knew exactly what you were doing. You waited until the real chain of command was asleep, and then you went in and launched the rescue without our final approval.
She angrily pointed a finger at him and said, And you put yourself right in the thick of it. Looking down at her desk, she picked up a file.
This is the after-action report filed by Lieutenant Jackson. Did you think I wasn't going to find out?
She threw the file down onto her desk.
You crawled into that damn camp by yourself and almost got killed.
Almost got killed, Rapp mocked her. Where the hell have you been for the last 15 years?
Every time I walk out the door, I almost get killed. That's part of my job.
Not any longer. You're not 25 anymore. We have other people who can lead the charge. You're not some buck private storming the beaches. You have one of the best counterterrorism minds in this entire town, and we can't afford to lose you over some macho need to be right in the thick of it.
Are you done?
Rapp looked at her defiantly. He knew there was some truth to her words, but he was sick of being on the receiving end of another tongue-lashing.
Could you try to see past your bruised ego at being left out of the loop for a few hours and thank me for a job well done?
General Morrow is dead. An entire 60-plus man force of Abu Sayyaf guerrillas has been silently exterminated. We have a new commander of the Filipino Special Forces who will vigorously take the war to the Muslim terrorists. The Anderson family has been rescued, and not a single asset was lost in the process.
Rapp held up his hand. The only problem was that yours truly got shot.
Kennedy decided to remove some of the emotion from the discussion. As good as it felt at first, she knew it was counterproductive. Especially when dealing with a bull like Mitch. He needed to be finessed, not pounded on. Thoughtfully, she nodded and said, Thank you for a job well done. Rapp immediately relaxed. He did not enjoy fighting with Kennedy, especially on the heels of what had happened last night. She had always understood him, probably even better than he understood himself. And I'm sorry if I hurt your feelings. You know I think of you and Tommy as family. It's just that... He shook his head in confusion. I've always been on the front line. You know that. I've always been left alone to make decisions as I see fit in the field. We handled the General Morrow thing without consulting you, and I saw no reason why I needed to call Washington and ask for the green light on the hostage rescue.
You didn't want to consult with us, answered Kennedy, because you didn't want to hear us tell you that you couldn't go on the mission.
Rapp thought about it for a moment and then admitted,
Maybe. Well, let's just chalk this one up as a learning experience. You're probably having a more difficult time transitioning into your new duties than either of us predicted.
Rapp shook his head and frowned. I'm not having any problems.
Yes, you are. In not so subtle ways, we need to sit down and clearly outline the parameters of your job.
She watched Rapp frown and said, Don't worry, I just don't want any ambiguity in the future. You're too valuable to this country, and too valuable to me as a friend, to be risking your life needlessly.
Somewhat reluctantly, Rapp replied,
All right. In a conciliatory tone, Kennedy asked,
Is there anything else you'd like to discuss?
No, not really. I'd... Just like a little less screaming and a little more gratitude.
I can work on that, Kennedy smiled.
And as far as the gratitude thing is concerned, well, I think you're going to get plenty of that.
Chapter 47 Rapp had never really taken the time to look around the Oval Office. He was usually ushered in, sat where he was told, and then left as soon as his audience with the president was over. This time, having declined to sit, he meandered around the room, checking out the various pieces of art and waiting for the president to appear. It was painful knowing that Anna was downstairs in her office. During the ride over from Langley, he had relayed his version of last night's events to his boss. She informed him in the gentlest of ways that he had neglected to do the single most important thing—
which was to simply say he was sorry. Rapp told Kennedy he felt torn. Yes, he was sorry that he'd hurt his wife's feelings. But she didn't marry an advertising executive. His injury shouldn't have been entirely unexpected. Kennedy stressed that, expected or unexpected, it didn't change the fact that in her mind, Anna could have lost the man she had just promised to spend the rest of her life with. Kennedy asked Rapp how he would feel if the shoe were on the other foot, and it was Anna who had been shot. The thought of losing Anna sent such a pain through him that he began to see her point more clearly. When he was done with this meeting, he would have to find her and apologize. Maybe he could even milk the shiner for a little sympathy. Despite his injury, he desperately wanted to be alone with her. Rapp was studying a portrait of Thomas Jefferson when Valerie Jones entered the office. For some reason, she was all smiles, which, as far as Rapp could recollect, was a first.
"Good morning, Irene," she said.
Kennedy replied with a simple, "Hello, Val." Jones turned her attention to Rapp.
"How are you, Mitch?"
Rapp remained facing the portrait of one of America's greatest presidents. Instead of turning around, he looked over his shoulder at the chief of staff. He and Jones had never gotten along. In fact, he could think of no other woman who he currently detested more. Regarding her suspiciously, he answered, "I've been better," then returned his attention to the portrait of Jefferson.
"Oh, that's too bad. How'd you get the black eye?"
Fortunately for Rapp, the president entered the room before he could answer.
"Sorry I'm late."
Hayes dropped a leather-bound folder on his desk and hurried over to greet Rapp.
"Mitch, once again, you saved the day. Great job over there in the Philippines."
"Thank you, sir." Rapp took his hand. The president's attention locked in on Rapp's shiner.
"Did things get a little rough for you over there?"
"Not too bad." Rapp shrugged it off.
"It looks like it hurts."
Rapp shook his head. "No, not really. I've had worse." The president nodded.
"Yes, I suppose you have. Well, listen, have a seat."
Hayes gestured to the couch opposite Kennedy and Jones.
"There are a few things we want to discuss with you."
"If it's all right with you, sir, I'd prefer to stand." Hayes stopped and gave Rapp a questioning glance. "It's my back, sir. If I sit down, I might not be able to get up."
"Oh, I see. By all means, stand if it feels better."
Hayes took his usual chair in front of the fireplace.
"Well," said the president, "at 11 o'clock, the Secretary of State and the Attorney General are going to hold a joint press conference announcing the prosecution of Assistant Secretary of State Petrie and Ambassador Cox."
Rapp was shocked. He'd figured the president would string him along for another few weeks and then let the issue die down. "That's good news, sir." Hayes looked up at Rapp, who was standing behind the couch on his right.
"I'm told Mr. McMahon has Ambassador Cox in custody and is on his way back?"
Rapp nodded. "That's right. The embassy staff was told the ambassador had to rush home for a family emergency."
"Good. The National Security Council is meeting next door as we speak. If you're still up for it, I've arranged for you to be present when Assistant Secretary Petrie is arrested."
"I wouldn't miss it for the world."
Hayes nodded and then turned to Kennedy. "Now, on to an issue that isn't so good. What in the hell is going on in Israel?"
"I'm working on that, sir."
The director of the CIA retrieved a file from her briefcase and pulled out a single sheet of paper. She handed it to the president and said, "That is a list of the terrorists who were killed in the attack." Hayes put on his reading glasses and scanned the names.
"Holy cow, is this for real?"
"As far as I can tell, yes, but the CTC is working to verify the names through other sources."
President Hayes stood to reread the list for a second time.
"What's the death count?"
"Again, the CTC is trying to verify the number, but right now the Palestinians are saying over 100 people were killed."
"Is that possible?" asked a skeptical Hayes.
Kennedy hesitated and then said, "Yes."
"But I thought they always exaggerated those numbers."
"They might not have to this time."
Hayes kept studying the list, even though he was thinking about something else.
"Of those 100 people, how many were terrorists?"
"Right now we're guessing anywhere from 20 to 40, but I stress that is only a guess."
"And the whole bomb factory story that the Israelis have been putting out?"
Kennedy shook her head. "It doesn't hold up. We have satellite imagery and radio intercepts of the attack. There was an initial explosion that we haven't been able to pinpoint. That blast destroyed the house where we think the meeting was taking place, and then there were a series of explosions that followed.
Where do those come from? Asked the president.
Kennedy hesitated for a second, knowing the president would not like the answer. They appear to have come from helicopter-launched missiles.
Appear to have?
Hayes wanted a more precise answer. The imagery people are saying they were Hellfire missiles launched from Apaches.
Back up a minute, ordered the president. Friedman told you that his people found out about this meeting and fired two missiles into the target area that ignited a secondary explosion that leveled the entire block, correct?
That's what he told me, sir.
And now you're telling me, said Hayes with a frown creasing his brow, there was an initial explosion that we have not been able to identify that was followed by a series of explosions that were caused by Hellfire missiles.
Yes.
How many?
16 of them, sir.
16? Asked an incredulous president.
I'm afraid so.
Why so many?
I have absolutely no idea.
Have you asked them?
Kennedy considered the question. No, I haven't, sir. I wanted to discuss it with you first.
Well, by all means, Hayes gestured to the bulky secure phone on his desk. Get him on the phone.
Sir,
cautioned the director of the CIA, I'd like to do a little more digging before we confront him.
Hayes was not in a patient mood.
The Palestinian ambassador to the UN is going to address the assembly this afternoon and demand that the UN make a full inquiry into this mess. The Saudi ambassador called me this morning to protest the slaughter of hundreds of innocent civilians.
Hayes shook his fist in anger.
This thing is not simply going to go away. I can get our ambassador to delay a vote by the Security Council until the end of the week, but we will not be able to put it off indefinitely. I need real answers, and I need to know what in the hell the Israelis are up to. I also need to know what our allies know. If we know they're lying, there's a good chance a few other countries know it too.
I'll get started on it right away, sir.
And Friedman, snarled the president, I want him to either start playing by the rules he agreed to, or we will terminate our arrangement and he can kiss his ass goodbye.
Kennedy nodded and told herself now was not the time to disagree with the president. The entire relationship with Friedman was fraught with potential disaster. The president could call up the Israeli prime minister and demand that Friedman be removed from his position as director general of Mossad, but even with the evidence they had, it might not work. Ben Friedman had files on everybody. She had a sneaking suspicion that if Friedman was ever really backed into a corner, he would use those files to take down anyone and everyone. There wasn't a thing that he wouldn't rationalize if it was done to help preserve either himself or his country. In a confident voice, Kennedy told her boss, "We'll find out what really happened over there, sir."
"Good."
Only slightly satisfied, the president turned to Rapp.
"And Mitch, I want you to take a very personal interest in this thing. You know a side of Friedman that no one else at Langley does. I want to know why he's lying to us, and I want to know what you think we should do about it."
"Yes, sir."
Rapp had a few ideas, but they would take some looking into. In the meantime, he was betting on his initial suspicion. Ben Friedman had only one master, his country. And no matter how closely they held his feet to the fire, he would never betray Israel.
Chapter 48. The National Security Council was one of those Washington terms that encompassed many things. In its truest sense, the council was made up of the president and a handful of very senior advisers. In a broader sense, it represented an entire staff that coordinated the flow of intelligence between various agencies and departments under the executive branch and the White House. One such group within that staff was the Counterterrorism Support Group. As their name indicated, they were charged with handling all issues involving terrorism, such as the kidnapping of the Anderson family by Abu Sayyaf. Due to the leaks that occurred at the State Department during the initial hostage rescue, the Counterterrorism Support Group had been left out of the loop during the second and successful hostage rescue. This intentional breach of procedure was missed by no one. In a town where being in the know was the ultimate sign of power, there were a lot of bruised egos. The rumors had been fast and furious as to why,
and through a few well-designed leaks, all were led to believe that their exclusion was due to a power play by none other than Mitch Rapp. These leaks, and his reputation in general, were the cause of the icy reception that awaited Mitch Rapp when he entered the National Security Council conference room on the fourth floor of the old executive office building across the street from the West Wing. The attendees, over a dozen of them, all stopped what they were doing and looked up at the unannounced visitor. The Department of Defense, the FBI, the CIA, the State Department, and Homeland Security were all represented. These were people just two rungs from the top. They carried great responsibility, they worked tirelessly, and they received very little public recognition. Of the people in the room, only Jake Turbis from the CIA knew Rapp. They all knew of him, to be sure, but not a one of them had ever said more than hello to him. Some of them respected him, a few despised him, mostly due to the embarrassment they were now forced to endure, but to a one, they all feared him. Here in their midst was a cold-blooded killer who had dealt with the national security issues they wrestled with every day in a much more real and final way. He was a man who came to meetings unannounced and rarely spoke. He was a man who had the president's ear, respect, and gratitude. He was a man who each feared could end any of their careers if he so chose. So, when he entered the long, narrow room, all of the attendees squirmed a bit, and to make matters worse, instead of taking a seat at the table, he remained standing. Rapp positioned himself in such a way that he could observe Assistant Secretary of State Amanda Petrie. Of all the attendees, only two besides Rapp had any idea what was in store. Jake Turbis of the CIA and Don Keen of the FBI were both in the know. Rapp kept himself from making eye contact with them and instead looked to Patty Hadley, the deputy national security advisor. He nodded for her to continue with the meeting. She smiled a bit awkwardly and said, "Well, you're just the man we were looking for." Her comment was followed by some uncomfortable laughter. Rapp allowed a wry smile to form on his lips. His problem was not with Hadley. "Fire away." "We're all trying to figure out why we were kept in the dark on this one." Rapp directed his response to Hadley. "The decision was made to keep this operation as close to the vest as possible." She listened to the answer, and then after a moment asked, "Why?" "Let's just say that our previous rescue attempt didn't go over so well." After a long moment of silence, Steve Gordon, the coordinator for counterterrorism at the State Department, was the first to speak. His pride had been damaged enough that he felt he had to speak for the group.
"I hardly think the people in this room were responsible for the failure of the first rescue attempt."
"Really?" asked Rapp, his tone a bit menacing. Gordon was slightly taken aback. He mustered up a bit more courage and reiterated his point.
"Yes."
"I wouldn't be so sure," said Rapp as he leaned against the wall and folded his arms across his chest, a red file shoved under his left arm. "Any other questions?" This time he looked directly at Amanda Petrie. He knew her type. Her righteous indignation would never allow his accusation to go unchallenged. She looked back at him, barely able to conceal her contempt, and completely oblivious to the role she'd played in the disaster of a week ago. The false belief that the rest of the group supported her gave her the confidence to say,
"Mr. Rapp, you may not think very highly of us, but you should at least respect the fact that we care about this country every bit as much as you do, and we work very hard at our jobs."
Rapp was simmering for the moment. He would blow later. This was a role he relished. It was an opportunity to remind everybody just how high the stakes were. What unfolded in this room in the next 5 minutes would be spread all over Washington by week's end. It would be whispered about around the coffee pots and water coolers, and it would grow and become more sensational with each retelling, and in the end, people would be reminded that national security was something to be taken very seriously. "To respond to your first point, I doubt very much that you care about this country as much as I do, and as far as your second point is concerned, I have no doubt that you all work very hard. But that by itself doesn't cut it. You people aren't on the board of some corporation. You are entrusted to help protect the national security of this country. And to be brutally honest with you, working hard isn't enough." Rapp's eyes never left Petrie's. Her nostrils flared just a bit, and unable to contain herself, she said,
"The State Department plays a very important role in this country's national security, Mr. Rapp, whether you like it or not. And for us to do our job, we need to be kept abreast of what is going on."
"Kept abreast," Rapp repeated her words and slowly bobbed his head as if he were taking them very seriously. "Tell me, Ms. Petrie, can you think of a single reason why the rescue operation was launched without consulting this committee?"
"I'd say somebody such as yourself advised the president that we be kept in the dark," answered Petrie with a look of disdain on her face.
"Exactly," said Rapp, his tone rising a bit. "And can you tell me why I would have advised such a move to the president?" There could be little doubt by the expression on her face that she hated the man who was questioning her.
"I have no idea."
Rapp opened the file under his arm and threw 2 5x8 photographs down on the table. They were headshots of the 2 dead Navy SEALs. "Do you have any idea who these 2 men are?"
"No,"
replied an indignant Petrie. "Irv McGee and Anthony Mason, United States Navy. They were killed last week on a little sand beach in the Philippines. Both were married, and combined they left behind 5 kids." Rapp made no effort to retrieve the 2 photos sitting in the middle of the table. This was as close as any of them would ever get to the 2 dead warriors, and he wanted to make sure everyone in the room looked at their faces. "Ms. Petrie, can you tell me how these 2 men ended up dead?" Rapp paused just long enough to see that she wasn't going to answer his question. "I'll tell you how they died," his voice boomed out in anger. "Someone in this room disregarded operational security because they felt the rules didn't apply to them." Petrie didn't crack a bit, and Rapp asked her, "You have no idea what you did, do you?" Petrie's face was now flushed, but she had yet to register what was happening. Blinded by her own belief that she was being wronged, Petrie said,
"You'd better have a pretty good explanation for this, Mr. Rapp."
The red file flew open, and out came the copies of Petrie's emails to Ambassador Cox. Rapp slammed them down on the table and yelled, "The president decided last week that our embassy in Manila was not to be told in advance about the hostage rescue. You ignored that order and sent Ambassador Cox an email alerting him to the specifics of the rescue. Well, I guess since you work hard and care about your country, you don't have to adhere to operational security." Petrie looked at her own email and still refused to admit any wrongdoing.
"I hardly see how this ended up causing the deaths of these 2 men."
"Because, you idiot," screamed Rapp, "Ambassador Cox alerted President Quirino about the operation, who in turn notified General Moro, who just so happens to be a paid asset for Abu Sayyaf. If you would have done what you were told, those 2 men would be alive right now. You and your fucking diplomatic arrogance got them killed, and that's why this committee was kept in the dark." Rapp stood at the end of the long table, his fists clenched in rage. No one attempted to speak. Amanda Petrie sat in shock, looking at the 2 photos, still refusing to believe that a simple email could have caused their deaths. Rapp knew that there were those in Washington who would think what he'd just done was unprofessional and insensitive, but he couldn't have cared less. In his mind, this town, especially the national security apparatus, could use a whole lot less sensitivity. Rapp turned and opened the door. 2 FBI agents were waiting outside to arrest Petrie. He passed them and started down the hall, his thoughts turning to the 2 dead SEALs. Their families deserved his sensitivity and sympathy, not Petrie. Chapter 49. David had practiced the routine precisely 8 times. He looked just like any other New Yorker as he walked up Park Avenue, his shoulders set with determination and the collar of his black trench coat turned up both to conceal his face and to ward off the bite of the cool March evening air. The pedestrian traffic had died down from its post-workday peak, but at 7:15, David was far from alone. Unlike in Jerusalem, however, David did not feel as though he were being watched. There was an outside chance that the FBI was trailing him, or an even slimmer chance that Mossad had somehow followed him to America, but David was confident in his ability to both elude and detect surveillance. No, he was alone. He'd seen the footage of the massacre in Hebron. Ben Friedman would think he had killed his Palestinian informant. The destruction in Hebron was so complete it would be some time before all the bodies were accounted for. And as far as the Americans were concerned, they had their hands full chasing Arab students on expired visas. David had already changed identities twice since leaving Hebron and was now traveling with a French passport. His first-class ticket from Nice to Paris to New York had been purchased with an American Express card that matched the name on his passport. He was now Charles Utrillo, a mergers and acquisitions specialist in town to meet with J.P. Morgan. The cover was not deep. If he was arrested and the FBI looked into his credentials, they would quickly discover it was a sham. The passport and credit card were merely there to ensure entrance into America without raising any suspicion. This portion of his plan had been relatively easy to put together. The West Bank was rife with arms merchants, and for the right amount of cash, almost anything was obtainable. David's purchases were never very large or exotic, mostly small arms, silencers, ammunition, and one very expensive rifle. He preferred dealing with the Russians. They were hungry for cash, and despite their recent cooperation with the West, they were still capable of keeping their mouths shut and records closed. Getting the weapons to the United States had been a little more difficult, but not much. The import-export business worldwide was known for not asking too many questions. David had shipped a crate of rugs to a warehouse in Philadelphia and picked it up back in January. Broken down and rolled up within the various rugs were two handguns and a Russian-made VAL silent sniper rifle. The weapon fired a 9mm subsonic heavy bullet and was capable of defeating standard body armor at distances up to 400 yards. According to David's information, his target wouldn't be wearing anything so cumbersome. The man had reason to celebrate this evening, and he wasn't about to put on a bulletproof vest to dine at his favorite restaurant. As David crossed 65th Street, he glanced to his right. Halfway down the block stood an old brownstone with bars and steel mesh over all the windows. In front of the house, on the sidewalk, the New York City Police Department had erected a blue and white guardhouse large enough for only one person. A police officer manned the post 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, just to make sure no one tried anything. David knew this was more to deter protesters and pranksters. The real security was inside the house. David had been invited there as a guest on many occasions. The brownstone was home to the permanent observer mission of Palestine to the United Nations. The Palestinian ambassador was a friend of David's, or, more precisely, a business acquaintance. Ambassador Hamed Ali was a childhood friend of Yasser Arafat's. The posting had been given to Ali as a reward for a lifetime of commitment and loyalty to Arafat. Ali was 75 and had a smoker's hack that made it abundantly clear to anyone who cared to listen that he was not long for this world. That helped to ease David's conscience a bit. That and the fact that in his younger days, Ali had sown plenty of death and destruction. The Palestinian Authority, due to its inability to raise money through taxes or tariffs, depended greatly on foreign aid and charity. David had proved his worth by personally delivering to Ambassador Ali $250,000 in the first 3 months of the year alone. Ali often complained to David that being an ambassador was a very expensive job. Diplomacy was almost always conducted under the pretense of a meal and never a cheap one. David responded by opening an account for the ambassador at his favorite restaurant, La Goulue. The French restaurant, one of New York's finest, was only 2 blocks from the ambassador's residence. David just so happened to know that Ali would be dining there this evening. He had spoken with the ambassador earlier in the day, congratulating him on his address to the UN. David had intimated that a celebration was in order. Ali agreed and invited David to join him and several friends at La Goulue. David noted the time, but turned down the invitation. He told the ambassador he needed to catch a flight to the West Coast. Ali had spoken to a rapt General Assembly, proclaiming that for a real and lasting peace in the Middle East, the UN must intercede.
he decried the unprovoked attack of innocent Palestinians by the Israeli aggressors over the weekend and demanded that the UN make a full investigation. In response to Israeli claims that the number of casualties had been grossly exaggerated, Ali read off a list of independent journalists and aid workers who were all reporting a death toll in excess of 100 people. As soon as Ali was finished, the Israeli ambassador took the floor and assured the assembly that as a sovereign nation, Israel was more than capable of conducting their own investigation into the matter. In a parting shot, the Israeli ambassador recommended to Ali that in the future they should locate their bomb-making factories in less populated areas so as to avoid so much bloodshed. The ambassador's quip was met with jeers and catcalls by the various Arab delegations. Right on cue, Ambassador Jussard of France took to the floor, pleading for civility and decorum. In the end, he promised the truth would be known. With the eyes of the international community focused on Hebron, France would work with the other permanent members of the Security Council to get to the bottom of what had happened. When David was finished tonight, the UN would be that much closer to intervening. And once an international force was on the ground, a Palestinian state would be that much closer to a reality. David crossed 66th Street and looked up at the towering behemoth before him. The 7th Regiment Armory was a colossal architectural throwback. Planted between Park and Lexington Avenues and 66th and 67th Streets, the 19th-century building was built to house New York's first regiment sent to fight in the Civil War. The massive building was no longer home to just the National Guard. It housed a women's shelter, various local and state social services, a restaurant, several nonprofits, and a catering business that could handle groups of up to several thousand people. David turned up the front steps behind a man roughly his age. Taking the steps one at a time, he was very conscious of what was under his trench coat. When he entered the building, the first thing he noticed was the roar of a crowd coming from the drill hall straight ahead. He didn't bother stopping to investigate. Earlier in the day, he'd read the marquee announcing a class reunion for Brooklyn Prep. David kept moving, turning to his left and going to the end of the hall, past the torn and battle-scarred regimental flags, past the elevator, and into the stairwell. In all of his previous visits, he had yet to run into someone on the staircase, which was a bit of a surprise, considering the condition of the elevator, and the fact that there was a good chance you'd have to share the small metal cage with someone who either suffered from a mental illness or an addiction to crack. He reached the top floor and then continued up another half-flight, where he was confronted with a locked door that led out onto the roof. David paused, turning on the two-way radio in his pocket and donning a flesh-colored earpiece. The digitally encrypted device was already programmed to monitor the same channel that the ambassador's security detail was using. David listened for a moment. There was no chatter, so he checked his watch. It was 7:21. Ali's reservation was for 7:30, but the man almost always ran 5 to 10 minutes late. David retrieved a lockpick from his jacket and went to work. He worked the tumblers to perfection. Having done it before, he knew where each one would fall. With the door opened, he stepped out of the dim stairwell and into the dark night. After placing a strip of duct tape over the metal frame, he allowed the heavy fire door to close. Standing in the glow of the city lights, David casually lit a cigarette. Several apartment buildings looked down on the armory. If any of the occupants cared to look out their windows, all they would see was just another desperate smoker trying to enjoy his vice. Slowly, David moved over toward the turret jutting out from the southwest corner. He puffed on the cigarette and looked around, scanning the adjacent buildings for anyone who might be watching him. So far, so good. He had it down to a science. It took Ali anywhere from 83 seconds to 3 minutes and 48 seconds to walk from his residence to the restaurant, depending on whether or not he made the lights at Lexington, Park, and Madison. David had time. It took him just 20 seconds to assemble the rifle, 15 if he was really pressed. He would wait until they were on the move before he did that. If, by chance, someone was watching him, he didn't need them to call the cops. At 7:29... David heard the familiar voice of one of Ali's bodyguards come over the earpiece. The man was going out to check the street.
David took a deep breath and reminded himself of his cause. To make peace, one often had to make war. He repeated the phrase over and over. Men like Ali and Arafat and Friedman would never agree to a real peace. It would take huge pressure from the international community, and America had to be a part of that. They were the only country that could force Israel to sit down and grant the Palestinian people a state, and after tonight, the tide would continue to swell. More chatter came over the radio. The second bodyguard announced that the ambassador was coming out. David had no idea who or how many people would be with him, or if he was meeting his guests at the restaurant. This was the part that he needed to be flexible about. It was out of his control. He started the stopwatch mode on his wristwatch, took one last drag from his cigarette, and then stabbed it against the wall of the turret. Well-versed in American investigative techniques, David placed the butt in a plastic bag and put it in his pocket, as he had done with each cigarette he had smoked while on the roof. He would leave as little behind for the FBI as possible. From one of his pockets, he grabbed a sock filled with rice and placed it in the base of the notch in the wall. It would help to balance the weapon and prevent leaving metal residue from the barrel. David opened his trench coat, grabbed a thick black barrel, and undid the Velcro that held it in place. He slid the barrel into the receiver and twisted it 90 degrees until it clicked into place. Next came the 10-power Leupold scope and a 20-round magazine. David extended the stock into the locked position, pulled back on the cocking handle, and then released it, chambering one of the special 9mm bullets. Casually, he checked his watch. He was at 29 seconds and counting. David took one last look around and then placed the heavy rifle inside one of the notches in the stonework. Like a medieval archer perched atop a castle wall, he prepared himself to take out the enemy. David looked through the scope to make sure everything was as he wished. The range had been checked for the southwest corner of Park and 65th. He'd zeroed the rifle in himself at a state park 2 hours north of the city. David was extremely accurate with the weapon up to 300 yards. A better marksman could probably take it up to 500 yards, but David had no kind of need for that distance. Tonight, his target would be roughly 145 yards from him. It was an easy shot, with one exception. Ali would be moving, and there would be people around him. David checked his watch again. They were coming up on a minute and a half. They must have missed the light at Lexington. David eased his grip on the rifle and scanned the street without the aid of the scope. He would see the bodyguard first, walking several paces ahead, clearing the way. As expected, the man appeared and stopped at the red light. David eased his eye in behind the scope and put the bodyguard in the center of the crosshairs. Then he moved the weapon to the east and soon found what he was looking for. The ambassador stopped just behind the man, and David let out a curse. Ali was with a woman. She had her arm hooked in his, and she was standing between David and his target. The light turned green, and the group began walking across Park Avenue. One bodyguard in front, the other behind, and Ali and the woman in the middle. David kept breathing in a steady manner and kept his hand relaxed as he followed the group, looking for a shot that wasn't there. When they stepped onto the curb on the other side of Park, he made his decision. He hadn't come this far to not take the shot, but neither was he going to kill a woman he did not know. He did not like it, but it was a contingency he'd planned for. He quickly maneuvered the rifle, bringing the crosshairs to bear on the head of the trailing bodyguard. David squeezed the trigger, and the rifle bucked just slightly as the heavy bullet spat from the end of the thick black barrel. He instantly chambered a fresh round, and a split second later David had found his next target. The man ahead of Ali was still walking, oblivious to the fact that his friend had suffered a mortal wound and was at this moment falling to the ground. Again, David squeezed the trigger, sending another round on its way. The rifle settled as another round clicked into the chamber, and David steadied the scope on his next and last target. Ali took two more steps before he realized something was wrong. The woman took 2.5 steps before she noticed the man falling in front of her. That extra half step that she took was all David needed. David watched as Ali turned, looking behind him for help from his other guard. The expression on the ambassador's face turned from one of shock to horror as he discovered that he was without protection. Before Ali could react further, David pulled the trigger for a third time and sent a final silent bullet into the head of his intended target. Chapter 50. It was dark outside, and the wind was howling off the big bay. Rapp stood in front of the full-length mirror in his bedroom and carefully pulled the bandages back from his wound. It looked like he'd been stepped on by an elephant. The bruising covered almost his entire right butt cheek and had already started to seep down into his leg. The doctors wanted him to stay off his feet for this very reason, but both he and the doctor knew the advice wouldn't be followed. He'd keep taking antibiotics and applying ice when he had the time, and he'd make it through just fine. He threw on a pair of sweatpants and a thick cotton T-shirt and carefully made his way down to the kitchen. Anna was on her way home from work, and Rapp was praying that she had calmed down enough that they could talk about last night without getting into another fight. Rapp wasn't much in the mood for any more screaming. He'd thought on and off all day about how he should have handled things with Anna. He'd screwed up, to be sure, but he wasn't completely off base. Anna knew who she was marrying. She'd seen him in action before and knew it could be rough. And on top of that, her father and two of her brothers were cops. The Philippines had been a successful trip. The Andersons were safe and on their way home. The deaths of the SEALs had been avenged. General Moro had been dealt with. Abu Sayyaf had been routed on their own turf. And General Rizal had requested the aid of the CIA in ferreting out any other traitors. It had been a good couple of days for the agency. On another front, however, things were not so good. Tensions between the Israelis and the Palestinians were approaching a dangerous level. There was a movement afoot in the United Nations to send in a team of independent inspectors to review what was already being called the Hebron Massacre. New footage was being released by the hour of tiny bodies being pulled from the rubble. The outrage was building to the point where several Jewish groups had taken to the airwaves protesting the heavy hand of Prime Minister Goldberg. Having been on the receiving end of perhaps the most horrific act of mass genocide in the history of mankind, Jews were very sensitive to the murder of women and children. As a people, they held the moral high ground when it came to suffering. And the last thing many of them ever wanted to see was their own people committing atrocities that drew comparisons to the Nazis. After returning from the White House, Rapp had gone straight to the CIA's counterterrorism center on the ground floor of the new headquarters building, where he was brought up to speed by Jake Turbis. He had been Kennedy's replacement when she'd vacated her post to become the new DCI. Kennedy had handpicked him with the consent of President Hayes. Turbis was a veteran of both Laos and Afghanistan. He was one of the few people left at Langley with any real field experience. This, probably more than any other reason, was why Rapp got along with him. It was amazing that Turbis, a maverick from Louisiana, had survived the agency's purges. The risk-averse CIA of the 90s did not treat case officers like Turbis well. He was a real throwback. And Rapp suspected that Turbis had only survived the various shake-ups by keeping a low profile and a little black book. Rapp had confirmed a rumor that one of Turbis's bosses had indeed tried to fire him. The boss, a slick climber, didn't like Turbis's rough style and gunslinger attitude and wanted him out. With 30 years under his belt, Turbis was informed that he was being forced into early retirement. Turbis politely declined. The boss told him he didn't have a choice. Turbis then told the boss that he knew all about the girlfriend he kept in Cathedral Heights, and that he would be more than happy to tell both his wife and the counter-espionage guys that he was keeping a flame on the side. The boss decided to rethink Turbis's early retirement, but that wasn't enough for the 53-year-old veteran. He told the supervisor he had 24 hours to resign from that agency, or he could kiss his reputation and family goodbye. The next morning, the boss resigned. Right now, Turbis was very unsettled about what was going on in the Middle East. Prior to the terrorist attacks of September 11, the director of the CIA's CTC was afforded a fair amount of anonymity. That was no longer the case. Congressmen and senators now called frequently, demanding to know what dangers were lurking on the horizon and what the CTC was doing to thwart them. Turbis had been forced to hire 6 extra people just to handle all the increased liaison duties between the Hill and the various federal departments. Turbis agreed with the belief that intelligence wasn't any good unless it was shared with the people who might be able to do something about it, but the politicians, by and large, did not fall into the category. As far as Terbis was concerned, there was one absolute about Washington, and that was that politicians loved to hear themselves talk. No matter how many times you told them that something was classified, there was always someone else they felt they could confide in. A wife, a girlfriend, a staffer without the proper security clearance. The list was almost endless. There were a few rare exceptions. A select number of senators and congressmen could really keep their mouths shut, and they were the people who, for the most part, had gravitated toward serving on the intelligence committees. The real plums for the egos on the Hill had always been judicial, appropriations, finance, and armed services. These were the committees that were most likely to garner them airtime and enable them to funnel pork back to their districts. But with the new war on terror, a few of the opportunists had forced themselves onto the intelligence committees so they could capitalize on the committee's sudden higher profile. Terbis kept a close eye on these people and had shared many of his concerns with Kennedy and Rapp. Just today, he had sat on two pieces of intelligence that were so inflammatory he didn't feel he could trust them with the committees until Kennedy gave the go-ahead. Kennedy had agreed wholeheartedly and had already scheduled an early meeting at the White House so they could brief the president. The first piece of intelligence involved the gruesome murder of an Iraqi general in the Middle East and counterfeit money, and the second involved the most taboo subject in the entire Hayes administration, the Saudis. Rapp knew when the president heard what they had to say, he was going to blow his lid. OPEC, for the most part, went the way of the Saudis, and a warm relationship with the Saudis could go a long way toward keeping oil prices stable. Rapp grabbed a pot from under the stove, filled it with water, and placed it on the burner. While waiting for it to come to a boil, he decided to check to see if they had any messages. There were two for Anna, and he saved them both. After adding the rigatoni noodles to the boiling water, he uncorked a bottle of red wine and started making the sauce. Shirley the Mutt sat on the floor watching him intently, waiting for any scraps that might fall her way. The extent of Rapp's culinary skills were limited to 3 or 4 pasta dishes and steaks on the grill. After he had the sauce going, he put 2 place settings on the breakfast bar. He would have to eat standing for a few more days. Anna arrived home just as the noodles were coming off the stove. She greeted Shirley and then set down her heavy black bag. After hanging her coat in the front hall closet, she entered the kitchen with arms folded and stopped on the other side of the small center island. Looking down, she fingered a stack of mail, most of it junk. Rapp dumped the noodles into the colander sitting in the base of the sink and looked through the rising steam at his wife, who so far had not acknowledged him. Deciding to take Kennedy's advice, he said, "Honey, I just want to let you know I'm very sorry about last night. I shouldn't have blindsided you like that. And in the future, I'll try to do a better job of letting you know what's going on." Anna did not look at him. She kept her eyes down and continued to finger the stack of mail. She had her hair pulled back in a tight ponytail, and slowly she began to nod. It was less of an acceptance of the apology than an acknowledgement that she'd heard him. Rapp watched her intently, not quite sure how this little game was supposed to proceed. With each passing second of her silence, he grew a bit more irritated. He'd made the first step, and she could at least thank him for trying. In a voice void of his earlier conciliatory tone, he asked, "Is there anything you'd like to say?" She shrugged her shoulders and continued looking through the mail. "I don't like this," she said without looking at him. "I don't like being so out of control. No one has ever made me this angry. This is not who I am." Rapp wasn't sure if he should reply, but something told him he should just keep his mouth shut and listen. "I've never known anyone like you. There's no relationship book out there on how to be married to a spy." Rapp smiled. "I'm not a spy." "You know what I mean." She kept her arms folded and looked him in the eye for the first time. Rapp nodded in silence. "I understand that I didn't marry a businessman. I know who you are, and I respect you and love you for everything you've done. But you have to remember you didn't marry a nincompoop who waits dutifully for you to come home every night and never asks a single question other than, 'How was your day?'"
Anna pointed to herself. That's not who I am. That's not who my mother was. I'm not going to live a separate life from you. I need to know what you're doing. I need to be kept in the loop.
She paused at the sight of her husband frowning.
Mitch, contrary to what you think, I know how to keep my mouth shut, and I'm sure as hell not going to say anything to anyone that might jeopardize your safety.
What about national security? He asked.
I'm not asking to know the names of the CIA's informants in Iraq. I want to know about you. The hardest part about all this is having no idea where you are or what you're doing.
It was all so strange for Rapp. He'd spent his entire adult life never having to explain to anyone anything about his job. It was something that he'd always kept tightly segmented from his personal life. The entire idea of opening up and sharing any of it with anyone was foreign to the point of making him almost claustrophobic. Even though he felt this way, he knew she made sense. If she were to suddenly leave the country with barely a moment's notice and give him no explanation of where she was going, how long she would be gone or what she'd be doing, it would drive him insane. There had to be some type of a middle ground where they could meet. Finally, he said the only thing he could.
I can't argue with a single thing you've said, but you have to understand it won't be easy for me. I'm not exactly a great communicator.
This made Anna laugh. No, you're not. But admitting it is half the battle. Seeing her smile made him feel better almost instantly.
Well, I promise I'll work on it, but you have to promise me you won't push too hard. Spouse or not, there are certain things I can't tell you.
And you need to promise me that you're not going to lead any more commando raids.
Rapp sighed and agreed. Anna and his boss were right. Though his job would never be a safe one, though he would certainly find himself in the eye of the storm again in the future, it had been plain, stupid, and unnecessary to involve himself so directly in the hostage rescue. It just wasn't his job anymore.
I promise.
He held out his arms, and Anna came to him. He grabbed hold of her and held her tight.
I'm sorry, Anna.
I know you are.
Anna embraced him and kissed his chin.
I'm glad you're home, and now you're never going to leave again.
Rapp ignored her and asked, Are you hungry?
I'm starving.
Good. Have a seat. Rapp pulled out a bar stool for her and poured a glass of wine. Efficiently, he prepared two plates of steaming noodles and added a healthy dose of red sauce to each. He grated a little Parmesan cheese and sprinkled it on top of each plate. Giving him one of her piercing looks, she said,
So, what do we have to do to make sure you never get involved in something like this again?
Rapp wasn't exactly crazy about his wife's choice of words. He was a man of action, and the phrase, never get involved, had far too much finality to it. To buy some time, he said, Irene and I are going to talk about it, go over some guidelines for what I should and shouldn't be involved in.
Anna took a drink of wine. I know this isn't easy for you, honey, but you've sacrificed enough. It's time to let some other people carry the load. My dad's been a cop for over 30 years. He didn't spend all of them kicking down doors and chasing bad guys.
Rapp knew she was probably right, but it didn't mean he had to like it. If the Philippines had proved anything to him, it was that he wasn't ready to call it quits. Somehow, he would have to sort all this out before another assignment came up, or he would make the same mistakes. Anna was about to say something else when the phone rang. Rapp walked over and looked at the caller ID. The call was from Langley. He grabbed the handset. Rapp speaking. He listened for a moment and then said, Jesus Christ, you can't be serious. After listening again for a few seconds, he said, All right, I'll be there as soon as I can, and then hung up the phone.
What is it?
Asked Anna with genuine concern. Someone just assassinated the Palestinian ambassador to the UN. Chapter 51. The last train for Washington, D.C. left Penn Station at 10:05 p.m. and arrived at Union Station at 1:20 a.m. David had purchased the ticket earlier in the day with cash and then gone about preparing for the evening's focal point. With the Palestinian ambassador now dead, he was ready to move on to the next part of his plan.
David regretted having to kill the two bodyguards, but there had been no other way. He tried to take comfort in the fact that their deaths would hopefully result in the birth of a nation. After leaving the armory, David had calmly walked back to the Sheraton Hotel on 7th Avenue, just a few blocks south of the park. He had chosen the hotel for its proximity to the theater district, the main hub of tourist activity for New York. With so many visitors from all over America and the rest of the world, it was effortless to come and go unnoticed. Once up in his room, David had sanitized the rifle one last time, even though he had never touched the weapon without wearing gloves. Each piece was placed individually in large green garbage bags, wrapped tightly, and then packed in the outside compartments of his wheeled suitcase. At 8:30, he left the hotel without bothering to check out. The room was under a credit card and would be billed automatically. He'd spied several construction dumpsters on 52nd Street earlier in the day, and he headed west in search of them. As he approached the first dumpster, he checked to see who was about and then casually unzipped one of the outer compartments of the black-wheeled case. When he passed under the scaffolding that protected pedestrians from falling debris, he found himself alone. David hurriedly threw two of the plastic bags into the cavernous receptacle. A moment later, he found himself standing next to the second dumpster. Quickly, he chucked the other two bags up and over the side, where they landed with a thud at the bottom. David continued west and caught a cab on 9th Avenue. He placed his suitcase in the trunk and then settled into the cramped back seat. The cabbie asked him where to and was visibly disappointed when David told him Penn Station rather than one of the airports. David settled in for the short ride and ignored the recorded voice of some celebrity he'd never heard of telling him to buckle his seatbelt. The easy part was over. Now he had to go to Washington and execute the most difficult aspect of his plan. Chapter 52. Mitch Rapp had seen the president in various states of anger, but this morning he appeared to be especially upset. Michael Hake, the president's national security advisor, had put out the word. President Hayes wanted everyone at the White House by 7 a.m. sharp. Kennedy had brought along Rapp and CTC Director Jake Turbis. She made it clear to both of them that she wanted them to keep a low profile during the initial meeting with the president's national security team. The information that the CTC had collected would be discussed later when the group was of a more manageable size. The large conference table in the cabinet room was surrounded by brown leather chairs, each of them exactly alike, with the exception of one. The president's chair had a higher back and was placed in the middle of the table so that he was the focus of attention. This morning, with his strained face and clenched jaw, he was very much the center of attention. Bloodshed in the Middle East was one thing. It wasn't good, it wasn't acceptable, but it wasn't a surprise either. The assassination of a foreign ambassador in New York City, along with two of his bodyguards, was absolutely shocking and unacceptable. President Hayes listened to FBI Director Roach relay the facts surrounding the assassination of the ambassador. When Roach was done, the president tapped his pen on a legal pad for a few seconds, and then asked in a very disappointed tone, "That's all we know?" Director Roach, the consummate professional, looked back at the president stoically and admitted, "For now, that's all we have, sir." In an unusually testy tone, Hayes replied, "I learned that much reading the Post this morning." Dismissing the FBI director with a shake of his head, Hayes looked one person over to Roach's boss, Attorney General Richard Lloyd. "Dick, I want this case solved, and I want it solved in a timely manner." The president stared at his old friend and added, "I don't care what it takes. Find out who did this and put them on trial and do it quickly."
This ends Disc 8.